I've had a mixture of doing very complicated physics, discussing with many, many people very intensively, and also sleeping a little bit, and then also there's going to be something on my second slide that we'll talk about. We'll get there. Before I get going, I should just acknowledge the people I'm working with. So I'm very fortunate in the Netherlands to have a very nice gang of people working for me, a gang of PhDs and postdocs. The work I'm going to present today is very focused on quenches. I'm going to talk to you about quenches in one-dimensional Bose gases, but also in lattice systems and spin chains. So this work was done by a subset of those people. There's somebody in the audience here. So Michael Brockmann is one of my postdocs. He's sitting at the back here. There's also a couple of PhD students. So there's Bram Wouters, Jacopo Denardis, who worked quite a lot on that. Davide Fioretto, another postdoc in my group, also collaborated on this project. And of course, all this is based on previous work. I've been working with Robert Koenig for many years on the ideas of quenches and things, and also with Fabian. I'll talk quite a lot about the recent work that Fabian already mentioned in his talk, and we'll apply it to different things. But before I get started, I mean, essentially, I'm sure you were all at the same place last night. So there are some moments in life that really make you believe in, you know, higher powers or tooth fairies or something like that. So this is destined to become one of the classic moments in the history of the greatest rivalry in sports, namely between the two teams that you recognize by now already. If you don't, then you can really wonder whether you've been in Canada or something. Anyway, so so Dino Chara, a kind of well-known, well-loved person in Montreal, ended up doing essentially an own goal at the critical moment in the third period, in the seventh match. So it's the seventh, it's the ninth time that the Montreal Canadiens play against Boston in a seventh match like that, and now it's 6-3 for Montreal. So Montreal can now move on to the next stage of the series. But anyway, so just to say in what kind of mood I am this morning is greatly influenced by this little moment here. But anyway, okay, so let's carry on with more serious stuff. Today I'm exclusively going to focus on out of equilibrium from integrability. So those of you who have seen some of my innumerable talks on correlation functions and things like that, you can rejoice because I will not show any of these things. If you want to hear about these things, just ask me privately. Instead, I will exclusively focus on out of equilibrium, and in the term out of equilibrium here, I'll adopt a very narrow focus on quantum quenches. I will consider two different quenches. First of all, the interaction quench in the Leib-Linegar-Bose gas that I will use as an explanation also for a method that we've developed to approach these problems. And then I will share with you some very recent work on quenches from the nail state into an antiferromagnetic chain. And then at the end, there'll be a lot of discussion, so we'll get back to that. Okay, so the models discussed in this talk, I'm sure, are very well known to you, just to remind yourselves and maybe set the notations. I will discuss the Leib-Linegar model, which is a model for interacting bosons in one dimension. The interactions are ultra-local. They're parameterized by, I guess the hockey stick will be the better pointer. So the interaction parameter is just given by this, this C. I'll focus on repulsive interactions for this model. Then, of course, there's the beloved XXZ spin chain Hamiltonian that we'll be talking a lot about. I guess you all know this extremely well. In the conventions that I adopt, it's the antiferromagnetic model. So delta is going to be positive, and I'll be talking quite a lot about the gapped case where delta is larger than one. Okay, so this is just to introduce the models. Now, I guess also many of you in the audience have used beta ansatz. If you haven't, let me just mention the crucial features of it that you probably should know in order to follow what I'm talking about. If you have a beta ansatz solvable model in 1D, essentially it means that you can write eigenfunctions in a particularly simple form. So you have an easy way of identifying a reference state, which is like a trivial eigenstate on which you will build all your space of states. Particles, of course, that depends on the model that you have. If you have atoms, they'll just be the particles themselves. If you have a spin chain, then downspins, for example, on a fully ferromagnetic spin-up background will represent your particles. And the statement that comes from Beta 1931, is that the exact many-body wave functions are simple combinations of plane waves. Okay, so you have a combination of free waves here that are glued together with precisely defined relative amplitudes. These amplitudes are just obtained from solving the time-independent Schrödinger equation. They're parameterized by a set of rapidities, which you can view as internal quasi-momenta for the particles. And very importantly, the wave functions, if you want, obey a form of Pauli principle. That means that you can formulate a basis of states with labels given by quantum numbers that essentially parallel what you would do with free fermions. So it's very important here because this gives you the classification principle for all states in the Hilbert space. It gives you essentially the means of making sure that you're able to write down resolutions of the identity correctly and then just do all your business with that. Okay, so that's just in a nutshell what the beta ansatz is. So the general idea that we're following in my group in Amsterdam is relatively simply stated. We're a bit monomaniacal. We do everything, or more or less, in the basis of beta states. So provided you can define an initial situation or a given problem in terms of these beta states and know what you want to do with it, maybe you want to apply some strange time evolution to this, maybe you want to apply some local operators and see how the correlations propagate in the system, you can obviously do that going back to your first year quantum mechanics textbook by just expressing everything on the basis of these states, provided you have matrix elements of the operators you're interested in the basis of these states. Okay, so there's a lot of technology involved in here based on the algebraic beta ansatz and reasonings therein. So if you're not too familiar with that, it doesn't matter as long as you understand that we are doing essentially baby quantum mechanics, just with slightly complicated wave functions that we nonetheless can control and whose results we can translate to physical quantities via, you know, representations of physical operators in this basis. Okay, so it's all extremely simple. Now, let me just maybe give a little bit of a motivation for what we do, maybe a tiny bit of perspective also into some longer term developments, which I would like. So we've seen this this example already. So Anatoly talked about this fabulous little system here, the rigid pendulum with the driving, which is periodic here. And then the amazing thing is that I think if you look in the literature, at least from what I got from Wikipedia, is that this was first described at the beginning of the 20th century. I think it's 1908 or 1909. It was first described that, of course, interesting things happen if you start driving this potential at a fast enough frequency, because then the equilibrium position just shifts to the upward position of the pendulum. And this was described in 1951 by Kapitsa. Okay, so if you're teaching essentially even renormalization to your students, this is a very, very nice example where you got separation of scales between the energies of different types of excitation. So the notion of integrating out high frequency modes is very well illustrated by that. But okay, so that's just the theory behind it. So I'm very fortunate to have a son who lets me play with his Lego. Of course, what I don't tell him is that it's really my Lego, but it doesn't matter. So I was looking on the web for movies of Kapitsa pendula, and it was kind of funny if you look for these movies, because then you see these people with these like drills and stuff, huge pieces of apparatus that go. I think at the Ig Nobel ceremony a couple of years ago, there was a guy with one of these hacksaws that had this, so you kind of see him going like this. But anyway, I guess I could do a Kapitsa pendulum with the hockey stick, but maybe, I don't know. I want to keep my teeth, so I'm not going to do that. Anyway, so Lego are just marginally, sufficiently, structurally stable to allow the construction of a pendulum. This is a pendulum that manages to oscillate at about 20 hertz. So the shafts in the Lego, they progressively get twisted and twisted, but that's okay, you can just undo it. There's just enough to demonstrate the principle. So, of course, this is interesting because it's a very simple illustration of what many people now are thinking about in our field. We've heard talks about that already. The idea that you can reach maybe new forms of correlated many-body states by applying some intelligent enough driving. So you stabilize different forms of many body states by manipulating them in certain ways. There's this very simple illustration of that. Now, of course, we can't do that really with beta ansatz. It's extremely difficult. So essentially, there are only limited circumstances in which we can use the tools at our disposal to make some non-trivial statements. So we've been thinking about that for quite a few years in my group, and we've got isolated realizations of reasonings that we can deal with knowing what we know. And today I'm just going to focus on these last two cases. So quench in the Liebliger-Bose gas, and then quench in the Heisenberg magnet. Okay? If you have any questions during the talk, you know, please interrupt me. Otherwise, I'll just rush through the thing. Okay, so let's just start with this interaction quench in the Bose gas. So you've seen the Hamiltonian before. The Bose gas eigenfunctions are given by this beta ansatz here. You might have seen some talks where I presented, for example, correlation functions of this. So you understand all these correlations, again, from beta ansatz. Okay, now what we will do is consider modifying the value of the interaction at some point. So here, this is really not driving the system in any way. It's really just quenching. So we do one instantaneous change, and then we will try to address the question of what happens a long time after this change. Okay, so the 1D Bose gas, of course, has one interaction parameter. If you stay with repulsive interactions, this parameter can just go from zero to infinity. And the difference in the states associated to the ground states of these different values of interactions, of course, are quite different. So at the extreme end, you get just a simple, completely free gas of bosons. The ground state is a quasi-BEC state in the sense that it's got a fixed particle number, but the state is completely translationally invariant. There is no essentially, the momentum distribution function is a trivial delta function at k is equal to zero. On the other extreme, you get the Tonk-Girardot gas, where if you want, the theory has a fermionic description, so the ground state becomes a bit like a Fermi C of these particles. The distances between the particles become highly correlated, so all the density correlations and fluctuations in this situation here correspond to those of a gas of free fermions. Okay? Now, an interesting quench is to consider going from the BEC state to a situation where the Hamiltonian is given by the repulsive Bose gas. So you just go from an initial state, which is BEC, which, you know, well, call it BEC. It's one we write here. So you just occupy the zero momentum mode n times. You have a finite filling here. So the density is taken to be finite. We put it on a ring of length L, if you want. So L is going to be commensurate with n. And you turn repulsive interactions on at t is equal to zero. So of course, physically, what you expect, it's relatively straightforward. Because in the initial state, the positions of the particles are completely uncorrelated, you would have, when you turn on the repulsive interaction, situations where particles are going to be closer to each other, and they will try to repair that here by flying away from each other. So the first expectation that you have is that the momentum distribution function, of course, instead of being this delta function at k is equal to zero, it's going to broaden in a certain way. In the Hamiltonian, the energy as measured in the final Hamiltonian, you just end up in a state which is very far away from the ground state. And you know, so loads of things happen. Now, I have to acknowledge extremely interesting discussions with Adilette. So Adilette is somebody who I worked with for a number of years before his tragic death a couple of years ago. Essentially, the projects about the interaction quench and the Bose gas were greatly fueled by, you know, his enthusiasm, his approach, and then our ensuing discussions. So I will try to tell you a little bit about the genesis of all these things as we go along. Okay, so the first thing that you want to do here, or that you want to try to do, is to try to compute what the steady state is a long time after this quench using, of course, the generalized Gibbs ensemble. Okay, so so let's do a first take on this. Okay, so this was a preprint from Adilette and his group, including Martin Kormos, Aditya Shachi, Yangji Zhao, also from a couple of years ago. And the idea goes as follows. So in the case of the Liebliger-Bose gas, we know the conserved charges. Of course, we can just compute the eigenvalue of charges, conserved charges in a certain certain eigenfunction, and these are given by the power sum polynomials here of the internal rapidities. Okay, so if you want all polynomials of this, represent your set of conserved charges. Now, if you look at the, if you want the morphology of these conserved charges in a second quantized representation, this was done earlier in the literature, you find that these charges here, they take the form of terms involving spatial derivatives of the field operators, plus a term which looks like a normal ordered moment of the density. Okay? Now, the idea was that if you start from the BEC state, all the terms involving spatial derivatives of these fields, they vanish, okay? Because the state is completely uniform. So it's quite easy to evaluate the expectation value of these charges on the initial BEC state, because you only need to evaluate this, okay? And that gives you the initial data that you need in order to implement the GGE. Right, so the way you implement the GGE is that you compute the expectation value of all the charges in the initial state, and you use that as the fitting parameters to determine your GGE density matrix. Okay, so it looks easy. You just evaluate this, these things you put to zero, and then you see what you get. So when you write down the GGE for this, you get a condition for the densities of these rapidities here, which is it's kind of a problem of moments for this distribution rho. This problem of moments has a nice little solution in terms of a semicircle law, right? So this is all extremely nice and very beautiful, but there's just one little snag. It's actually incorrect because of a little detail. Okay, so let me just tell you what that is. The problem is that when you actually evaluate the charges carefully, you notice that they do not take finite values. So changing the value of the interaction in the Bose gas has actually an extremely drastic effect. The way you see this is by considering, very simply, the case of a few particles. When you put even two particles and you change the value of the interaction, what you notice is that the overlaps of the wave function, of the initial wave function with those of the final Hamiltonian have a characteristic that the value of the overlap is algebraic in 1 over the rapidity here. Okay, so this, think about it like doing a Fourier transform of, say, a Heaviside function or some cusp function like this. It will decay algebraically. But this is, of course, problematic because if you, for example, evaluate the expectation value of the energy in the initial state, that's all fine, it converges, so energy is just lambda squared, you sum it with these amplitudes here, so this gives you a finite number. However, the higher conserved charges are higher degree polynomials in these quasi-momenta, and therefore, the number of these expectation values that converges is just finite. In fact, it's brutally cut off because the first non-trivial charge here that has a non-zero expectation value in the initial state already diverges like the delta function of x is equal to zero. So we are dealing with a continuum theory. This theory has absolutely no ultraviolet cutoff. And the first non-trivial charge above the Hamiltonian measures essentially the dimensionality of your Hilbert space, if you want. Okay, so it just diverges as what you would, the inverse of your ultraviolet cutoff, which is mathematically zero here. Okay? So, of course, for higher charges, Q6, Q8, etc., the divergences are even worse. By the way, only the even charges here are non-vanishing because the odd charges are just odd under parity, and the initial state is parity invariant, so therefore all the odd charges have vanishing expectation values in the initial state and don't give you any information. Okay, so the problem that you have is that because of the delta function interaction in the Bose gas, the wave functions have cusps at the points where coordinates of two particles coincide. At different values of the interaction, if you compare the wave functions, they have mismatching cusps, if you want. Okay, so that doesn't work. And it's very important to understand that these divergences, they are not cured by any thermodynamic limit in here. It is truly because there is no UV cutoff in the theory. So going to a system with L and N going to infinity will never allow you to regularize this. These divergences are there, even in the finite system. Okay, so that's a bit of a problem, right? Because how do you implement GGE if the expectation values of the charges are all infinite? Okay, so then you you try something else. You say, well, okay, if the charges are problematic, then let me work with different charges. Christian. It wouldn't help you. Okay, so the statement.
So it diverges in the excited state of the initial. I mean, like if I didn't do a quench, but I started not with the ground. In the ground state of the initial Hamiltonian, all these charges are zero, except.
Yeah, but starting from a different state than the BEC state, but quenching the interaction would still not help you. So I think the statement I want to make about quenches in the Bose gas is that if you quench the interaction, then this logic will always give you problems. So if you go from any initial state at a given C, and you go to any different C, then you will have problems. Here, you see the situation is that the delta function interaction, it's unbounded, right? It can take arbitrarily large values. And this is precisely what you're doing. You're quenching an operator that has unbounded matrix elements, if you want. It has unbounded, you know, capabilities of changing states into each other. So that just doesn't work. What would happen is that if you were able to do a quench situation where instead of working with Lieb-Linegar, you would have a regularized potential, so you know, just a regularized delta function, then it will always work. But you would see explicitly the scale of this regularization appear in the expectation value of the charges. Right, so like the Q4 would then be essentially the inverse of the length scale associated to your regularization of the delta function. So you could do that, but that's also a bit strange because then you'd look at higher and higher charges and they would be higher and higher powers of this inverse cutoff. So, you know, it's not clean.
So it seems like the model, at least the dynamics, or the most general dynamics, is not really defined yet, in the sense that it's not regularized.
Yeah, you'll see that there is actually no problem with the model. Yeah, so because. You'll see. I'll give you four different ways of thinking about it, and the fourth one will give you everything you want to know. Yeah. You had a question?
Even though you're changing the coefficient and unbounded operator, you're doing a finite amount of work on system?
Yes, yes. That's right. Yeah, so you go to a finite value of C, and then the expectation value of the energy is finite. It only diverges when you put the final interaction to infinity.
Yes. We're going from the Bose to Fermi system, effectively. So there are so many phase shifts now, the various rapidities.
You see, it's slightly different from orthogonality catastrophe, because orthogonality catastrophe gives you essentially you know, zeros of the overlaps, but as a function of system size. System size enters
but
here.
This is worse than that.
This is much worse than that.
That's what, yeah.
This is much worse than orthogonality catastrophe, right? It's like orthogonality, I don't know, cataclysm. Right? So. Okay, so if the charges are problematic, then let's use other charges. Okay, so then you go back to your maths books when you learned about symmetric polynomials and stuff like that, and you say, oh, okay, there's another basis for symmetric functions. Of course, beta wave functions are symmetric functions of these rapidities, so you can just, instead of the power sum polynomials, consider the elementary symmetric polynomials that are just defined by this relation here. Okay, so it's kind of the ordered product up to a certain order of the rapidities in the state. Now, this is great because if you evaluate these charges on any finite energy eigenstate, you can trivially show that the expectation, I mean the eigenvalue of these higher order charges, they're strictly bounded. So they never become infinite. So there is never this problem of these delta of x equal to zero divergences in these charges. Okay, so when I thought about that, I was very enthusiastic, started calculating. It's just great. Then you can also look at the second quantized form of these charges. The same logic applies, but now these derivative terms here don't give you problems. This term here is just different from the one that that you had for the original charges. You evaluate this on the BEC state, you get conditions for this, and then you do your maths. You have to consider finite size corrections here. And then what you obtain is that it gives you back the semicircle law that you had with the other Q charges. So that's a bit bizarre. When I got that, I was very surprised because I thought this would be the solution to the problem, but it turned out not to be the case. So what is going on? Well, the point is that these new charges, they're just a dressing up of the old charges. So if you look at the relationship between these J charges, so these elementary symmetric polynomials, and the Qs, there's a formula which is known as the Newton-Girard formula. I wrote Girard-Newton because Girard seemed to be historically preceding Newton. So anyway, but that's the way it is. So there's a polynomial mapping between these two sets of charges. And essentially, for example, if you look at the first non-trivial J that you have, you get just a difference between these two. And you see, this was good because you had delta of x is equal to 0 in here. But then this delta of x0 was appearing in here as well, so it was canceling. And that's why these things become finite. But there's a little subtle problem. Essentially, then you remember all these discussions you've had with your buddy Marcos Rigol. And then you say, oh, OK, so the GGE is OK only if the widths of these charges vanishes, right? But that's precisely the problem here. Although the expectation value of these j's taken individually converge to finite values, if I take the expectation value of j squared in the initial state, this is infinity, because j squared is like q. Okay, so even with these charges, you cannot do the GGE. You're not allowed to do that. You don't fulfill Marcos's condition for the application of these things. So the JGGE is no better than the QGGE. Okay, so all right, charges don't work. So if the model poses a problem, then you change the model. Okay, fine. So what you do is that you go to this strange Q-deformed version of the Leib-Linegar boson, which lives on the lattice. Okay, but it has this Q-deformed bosonic algebra here. It becomes a lattice model. Therefore, I have a UV cutoff now, this little delta. And then, fortunately, magically, this model still has the feature of being integrable. Therefore, you can do quite a lot. And at the end of the calculations, you can just go back to Leib-Linegar by taking this cutoff to zero, okay, in a precisely defined scaling fashion. Great. So the nice thing is that you can just then construct your charges using the standard machinery of the algebraic bit ansatz. Namely, you have trace identities for this that give you higher and higher order local charges in here. So these are, for example, a few of them. And what that allows you to do is a truncated GGE, where you include a few of these charges, you solve the GGE problem, and then you obtain a description of the steady state in terms of the density distributions of these rapidities representing the state. Okay, so such a function here is just a distribution function for these lambdas. So the way you should read this is that this is a wave function. It gives you a wave function. Okay, so this is nice because when you look, for example, at large rapidity here, you find these tails. You remember the original solution was just a semicircle, so it was brutally truncated at a finite value of the rapidities. But now this GGE on the deformed model already clarifies why the higher charges diverge in the initial state. Because my density here is 1 over lambda to the 4. So if I want to evaluate Q4, I need to integrate this over all lambda times lambda to the 4. So I get delta of x is equal to 0. Okay? So this is all fine. But of course, the problem is that taking this further is extremely labor intensive. So you would have to compute the explicit value, the explicit operator expression of the higher charges one by one, evaluate them on the BC state, and then solve the GGE problem. Okay, so there's no way to obtain a closed form solution in this fashion. It's too complicated. Okay, so then let me then switch to a completely different line of attack on this. So this, let me introduce to you this quench action approach. So Fabian already mentioned this. This is something I developed with him. I guess we published it last year. At first, I'll just try to give you explanation for it in pictures, although I guess Fabian already explained quite a lot of it. So the idea is as follows. You have an initial state, which, for simplicity here, it's not a requirement, for simplicity is described by an eigenstate of a certain Hamiltonian, certain prequench Hamiltonian. So if you plot, if you want, the amplitudes of the initial state in the basis of the initial eigenstates, you get like a delta function at some point in your Hilbert space. Now, this state is, of course, mathematically equivalent to the description of this state, but in the basis of the post-quench Hamiltonian. It's just that now it's not a delta function, it's not a peak, a single state. It becomes a splash of amplitude, which is distributed in some complicated fashion. Okay? But this is exactly the same quantum state. Now, of course, the time evolution is going to be simple in this basis here. Of course, every single point in here will oscillate with its own frequency. Okay? And the problem of relaxation just becomes a problem of dephasing in this new basis.
Being on the lattice, do you now have a finite dimensional Hilbert space or not?
No, so this, I'm back in the continuum. But whether you're on the lattice or the continuum, when you take the thermodynamic limit on the lattice or in the continuum for the Lieb-Linegar, you'll get smooth distributions here.
If you were to stay on the lattice, which again, you don't want to, do you have a finite dimensional Hilbert space on the lattice?
Yes. Yeah, but you take the thermodynamic limit. So all this approach here will give you results in the thermodynamic limit. So you're on the lattice, but you take the limit of an infinitely large lattice. But you keep the lattice. You don't put the lattice spacing to zero.
But on one lattice side, what's the dimension of the Hilbert space?
Two. Yeah. Ah. Yeah, so here I'm really back to Lieb-Linegar, bog-standard Lieb-Linegar, or bog-standard Heisenberg. No Q deformed. Yeah. Okay, so the idea is that you view this problem as a kind of field theoretical problem where you have an effective action which is dictated for you by the overlaps with the initial state. Okay, so this is just the pictorial description. I'll give you the equations in a few minutes. Okay, the idea is that you get this pseudo-free energy, if you want, that is driven by the overlaps themselves. Okay? Because the wave function is normalized, this effective action here is defined so that it's bounded from below. Okay? So there's a picture that you can have is that this action, essentially plotted in the Hilbert space here, has such a morphology. And then the statement is that the steady state of the system is going to be obtained by considering essentially an optimization problem on this. Okay, so you'll have a variational approach that you can do with some generalized form of thermodynamic beta ansatz reasonings that allow you to describe the steady state. Okay, so statement is that a long time after the quench, all the dephasings that can take place have occurred, and the only features that you see come from states living at the saddle point of this effective action. The way you get to this saddle point is dictated by states in the vicinity of this saddle point. Okay? I'll show you this maybe from the equations. It's going to be clearer. Okay? So that's the general idea. Now, in equations. Okay? So let's go back to the beta basis. Let me now essentially use the language of beta ansatz here. Although the idea itself, the logic itself, does not require beta ansatz. This is just a language thing. If you had exact eigenstates, you know, using another method, you would just be able to do this as well. So you start from a resolution of the identity in terms of a sum of projectors onto the complete set of eigenstates that you have. And your initial state is then rewritten as this exact linear combination of the initial states, where now the projection coefficients are simply written in terms of this effective, you know, parameter here, which is just the log of the overlaps. Okay, so if overlap is zero, then this quantity goes to plus infinity. Okay, so this is just a mathematical identity. Now, the time dependence in this notation is completely trivial to reinsert because you just get the phases of each state. So the omega I are just the energies of the state I. Okay? Now, you're interested in expectation values of observables. So give me any operator you're interested in. Its time-dependent expectation value is simply psi of t, O psi of t, which you rewrite as this mathematical identity, which is still absolutely exact. but involves a double summation in Hilbert space. Of course, it's difficult to implement that, so you have to try to find some tricks to evaluate this. Okay? So, you start by looking at the expression that you get for the wave function normalization itself. I mean, I know this is one, but still, it's instructive to look at it, because when you take the thermodynamic limit in beta ansatz, what you want to do is move from a description in terms of quantum numbers to a description in terms of a functional integral over these functionals rho, over these functions rho, that, if you want, are coordinates for your eigenstates. Okay, so the way you would write a summation over eigenstates would be as a functional integral over these functions here, weighed by some fugacity, if you want, that defines the so-called Yang-Yang entropy for states. The non-trivial step here is that you will then identify states that differ from each other by microscopic changes at the level of the quantum numbers. But this doesn't matter in the thermodynamic limit. Okay?
This need not be simple.
This need not be simple. This is not simple. Yeah. It is not simple, but it is fully controllable. That's the statement. Okay? Now, when you put the effective overlaps here, so you look at that here, what you obtain is that, for example, this expression for the wave function normalization becomes this functional integral here, where you get an effective action which comes from the overlaps, so these are just the logs of the overlaps, the real parts of the logs of the overlaps, with the entropy here, which is just the bog standard entropy that you will know if you've done any thermodynamic beta ansatz. Now, the saddle point condition, so the state, the class of states that contributes the most to this normalization here, are the states whose distribution rho satisfies the saddle point condition of this effective action. Okay, this quench action. Now, you solve precisely this kind of problem using this generalized thermodynamic beta ansatz, which is not very complicated. It's just usually when you do beta ansatz, thermodynamics, you have the energy, so the Gibbs weight, giving you this, this weighing here. Okay, so you'd have the bare energies here. But in this case here, it's just the overlaps setting this, this effective functional. Okay? Now, for the operator expectation values, you can then just look at this and then make a number of statements. So first of all, you will restrict to a class of operators, which I call weak operators. That is, operators that in the thermodynamic limit do not cause a thermodynamically large reorganization of the state. Okay, so this is already a restriction. For example, density matrix over half the system size would not be a weak operator. But local density operator, or powers, finite powers of local density operators, would be. Okay? In that case, what you have is that one of the two Hilbert space sums drops off. Because one of the Hilbert space sums you essentially keep as the basis here, but since your operator is weak, it will only be able, starting from this state, to give you a state that has the same distribution in the thermodynamic limit, modulo a series of excitations that you can then label with, if you want, discrete indices. Okay? So you get like a denumerable set of excitations. So think, you know, if you had a quantum liquid, you would sum over 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 particle hole excitations around your state. And then you would have converged. Okay? So this is a thing to test. It is possible to refine this criterion of weakness for operators. Be happy to discuss that if you want. The important thing is that you then get relative overlaps. So this delta S here is just, if you want, the difference in overlaps between this state and this state. So how adding excitations modifies the overlaps. Okay, now, if you have operators whose matrix elements are not entropically large, that is, they're not of the form e to the constant times n, then you can perform a saddle point evaluation of the expression I just had, and then you land on this expression here. This expression gives you, in the thermodynamic limit, the full time dependence of the expectation value of operator O in terms of matrix elements evaluated on the saddle point states up to discrete excitations, summed over the excitations, weighed by the relative overlaps. Okay? And the statement here is that this expression here, it is not a large time expression in the thermodynamic limit. This will be valid at all times. Probably you need to wait a tiny bit of time to let the exponentially fast oscillations die out. But at a finite time, this would start converging very economically. So the message here is that the full time dependence, not only the steady state, the full time dependence is recoverable using a very minimal set of data. What do you need? You need the saddle point distribution, so this rho saddle point here. Once you have the saddle point distribution, it's very easy to, if you want, calculate the excitations in the vicinity of this state. This is a completely bog standard problem in beta ansatz, taking a certain state, adding excitations to it, and calculating the energy differences between these states. Completely trivial. Well, not trivial, but easy. You need the differential overlaps between these states. Okay, so how adding an excitation modifies the overlap. If you want, you can think of this as a new form of dispersion relation. It's not energy, it's overlap. But there would be a dispersion curve for the overlap, which you could then also characterize by reduced parameters. Maybe it would have an effective velocity and then an effective mass and things like that. But this would be then for the differential overlaps. And then provided you have some information about matrix elements of the operators you're interested in on this state and around this state, then you can just apply this formula. Okay? Yes? So the saddle point, the existence of the saddle point is guaranteed by the thermodynamic limit itself.
So it's 1 over n?
Yes. One over, yeah. Yes.
Are you guaranteed that there is only one minimum?
No. No. But you see, in a sense, you've dealt with field theories that can have multiple minima and things like that. So the generalization is completely trivial. The logic is just like when you do field theory. So if you have multiple things, you just sum over the saddle points, and that's it. Okay, and you can even go beyond. Usually you have a saddle point, you calculate the Hessian, you can do the functional integral, you get 1 over determinant of the matrix, the Hessian matrix, et cetera, et cetera. Same thing here. Okay, completely the same thing here. So you can find a reduced description in terms of these effective parameters. Okay, but this is the kind of basis for this effective reduced description. So once again, the amount of information that you have here is infinitely small as compared to the original exact problem, which means calculating Dym-Hilbert space overlap coefficients. Here you would just have a number, you would have a function, another function, another function. And then here this is slightly more complicated, but you can still control it. And that would be it. Okay, so it's extremely simplified as compared to the original problem. Okay, but let me say that. So for example, if you're interested in the actual steady state expectation values, you can just take the t to infinity limit of this and then keep only the diagonal terms. So the statement is that the saddle point state itself is enough to give you all the steady state expectation values. So the expectation value of the operator in a single appropriately chosen eigenstate, rho saddle point is an eigenstate, would give you the correct answer. Okay? So that's the quench action method. Now back to the BEC Lieb-Linegar quench. Of course, the whole construction of the quench action is predicated on the overlaps. You need the overlaps. Okay, so that's the devil in the details. It's quite complicated to do that. So I've already told you, so these odd charges vanish. So essentially what you obtain is that only parity invariant states contribute. Yes?
So the quench action method didn't use any fact that
the counter is integrable. The logic is not using it. So if you have another method that gives you exact eigenstates, then you can do this. Right? So the only reason, the only place where I've used integrability here is in the language. But of course, if you give me another, instead of rows, you call them chi's, and it means something else for you, but you know that they are eigenstates, then just do this in this language, and it's going to be exactly the same. So there's no limitation to beta ansatz, 1D, or anything in here. It's just completely general. Okay? But of course, for the implementation, I have to show you that this works, so I'm only able to implement it with these beta ansatz things. So if you look at these...
Yes, but a priori, right, you cannot know if the answer is going to be correct.
No.
You don't know if the observer is smooth.
Absolutely.
You cannot prove it.
Absolutely. No, so you're observable. So you see, there would be cases where the observable itself is enough, is not thermodynamically finite, and it shifts the saddle point. But then it still, you know, can go back to the steps and do a different saddle point evaluation, and then you would have ratios of effective saddle points in the numerator and denominator that might still allow you to calculate that. But this is not meant to be true for all observables. So the expression I have for O of t is for weak thermodynamically finite observables. Okay? But that really means essentially all the observables you will be interested in say, spin chains or Bose gases. So any moment.
That those observables satisfy those conditions?
Yes.
All of them?
Yes. So the only thing that I would imagine doesn't satisfy it is, for example, if you ask me for the reduced density matrix over a finite fraction of the system size. And this would not work. But you know, reduced density matrix on a finite length in the thermodynamic limit, no problem. Right? Yeah, you can make those statements precise. Okay, so back to the overlaps. Essentially, so you get that. And then the question is whether you can get overlaps for the generic interaction value. What time do I have? I started at 10 past or something. Eh? Okay, I'll see. So it's going to accelerate a bit then. Okay. So that's the great thing about having junior people working for you, because you give them impossible problems and then you wait and see what happens. And then one morning, essentially, one of them came into my office and said, "Oh, I think we have an overlap." No. So we've looked into that. We've been thinking about that for years. Must be joking. So indeed, okay, so there was a conjecture at first that the overlap between the initial BEC state and a parity invariant beta state would take the following form, essentially a determinant of a matrix, which is, for those of you who know it, a kind of modification or glorification of the Godin matrix. Okay? So the statement is that the mathematical overlap here is given as an explicit function of these rapidities here. Okay, so Mikhail actually managed to prove this formula earlier, so we don't have any doubt here anymore about this. Okay, so now that we have the, oh, and this, by the way, is valid for any final value of the interaction.
Is it a Hessian or something?
It's not quite, but yeah. You can view it. I mean, so the usual Godin matrix is like the Hessian of the Yang-Yang action. You can view it like that if you want, but that's not the way you really derive it. Okay, so now the nice thing is that we have the explicit overlaps for finite systems. We can then take the thermodynamic limit of these overlaps and see how they scale. And this is what you get. I will get back to this formula later on. Very importantly, there's a log. Okay. So that's just great, because this defines your quench action. You can then sit down, do the generalized thermodynamic beta ansatz, obtain the saddle point state, and this gives you the steady state of the system. So a remarkable thing here is that, unlike what happens with thermodynamic beta ansatz for Liebliger, you can here give a closed form solution for the root distribution in the steady state. Okay. More informatively, you can just plot it for various values of the final interaction. If you're at very weak interactions, it becomes more and more like the semicircle law that was predicted by Adilet and collaborators. But if you go to higher and higher final interactions, it of course becomes this kind of shape with tails here. So in this subplot here, there's the difference between the actual distributions that we get and what would have been the distribution had we had a thermal ensemble at the end. Okay, so you see the mismatch between the two. So you can just look at the various limits. So it reproduces the large C limit, small C semicircle. It also fits with the asymptotics that you got from the Q boson lattice regularization. So everything is completely sorted. All the divergences are explained. Okay, so in that paper, that's what we give. We give the exact steady state here in the thermodynamic limit for this quench to a non-trivially interacting model. Amazingly, this was not enough for the referees we had in PRL, who also said that you should have a trap. So that's a criterion for PRL from now on. You should have a trap, you should be in the thermodynamic limit, you should be exact, and you should have non-trivial interactions. So that's not the PRL I'm used to. But anyway, you can then compute steady state properties onto this state. So for example, you can look at moments, local moments of the density, see how it scales with different values of interaction, and you get these exact curves here. Okay, so behavior is just non-thermal. One of the things that you can look at as well, like I said, the quench action is applicable to relaxation. So you can easily reproduce this result that Martin Mario Pasquale derived for the quench to the Tonks-Girardot gas. So you can do that then because you've got the free fermion basis for you. And from the quench action, you can just see this coming out relatively easily. So the relaxation at finite C is ongoing work. Okay, so we're still thinking about that. It's going to be difficult to give a closed form solution, but at least we should be able to get some plots. Okay, so just maybe a little minute thinking back on this. Why, you have to realize what I'm saying here. I told you that it was impossible to do the GGE, but now I've given you the exact solution. Okay, so you can now try to match the two. So for Lieb-Linegar, we had charges that were of this form here. Now, the effective free energy for the GGE would be a linear combination of these charges here. So then this would be kind of expansion in powers of this lambda. But we know from the exact overlaps that the effective free energy is logarithmically dependent on lambda here. So the failure of the GGE implementation with these charges here in this case is simply because you can't expand log lambda in a power sum in lambda. Okay? There would have to be one extra charge. If you give me one extra non-local charge that has as eigenvalue sum over log of lambda j, then the GGE brutally converges. And this is the single most important charge. Now, I know this charge exists because I can construct it. I can declare it. You know, call it Q-log. Q-log, I will give you all the matrix elements for it. Diagonal with diagonal entries, sum over j of log lambda j. You allow me to put that into GGE, and then GGE converges brutally. At large interactions, you only need this charge. Okay? And doing the GGE, truncated GGE around this charge with a finite order is like doing a 1 over C expansion. Okay? So in a sense, there's nothing wrong with GGE. GGE is just working very well. There's just one charge missing. Okay? So that's the statement that you have here. Okay, so GGE like that is not directly implementable, but yeah, so quench action was not affected by these features. Okay, so that's it for the Bose gas. Let me now, want to spend more time on this, but let me try to run you through this. Let's now consider another setting, spin chains. We're starting from an initial state, which is purely anti-ferromagnetically set up over the whole chain. From t is equal to 0 onwards, we will then evolve with the XXZ Hamiltonian. So of course, these spins are going to start fluctuating wildly, and the question is whether you can do this exactly. Okay, so of course, XXZ is much richer than Lieb-Linegar, at least than repulsive Lieb-Linegar, because the solution of the beta equations take the form of free magnons, but also bound states of these objects. So there are new types of particles, these strings, that show up that you have to deal with. Okay, so things that you might know about strings in these magnets. Okay, so the quench action approach to this nail to XXZ quench starts, of course, once again by computing overlaps. So once again, so many people have done that. So there were preliminary formulas here that were obtained. What we did is that we were able to show that you could also bring them to a Godin-like form here. Now, this is quite significant because this makes them, if you want, implementationally useful. Okay, so once again, there's a generalized Godin determinant, or a kind of a deformed Godin. How did we agree to call it in the end? The referee didn't like generalized Godin determinant, but yeah, we're fine. I like generalized Godin determinant because this was GGD. And then it was like GGD for GGE. But somehow the referee shot that down. I guess didn't get the joke. But anyway, that's it. Okay, so you get, once again, explicit overlaps to these Heisenberg XXZ states from the Néel state. And then you can just do the generalized TBA. The generalized TBA, of course, is much more complicated here because instead of having just one distribution function, you get an infinite number of distribution functions, one for each type of particle in the chain. Nonetheless, you can control this calculation. The solution of the generalized TBA here gives you, once again, the steady state. You can write this generalized TBA in an equivalent way, kind of nearest neighbor interaction form. And the point is that, let me just go to the next slide. So this would be the driving term with the GGE betas in there, but you can do something nicer. Then you look at recent literature on this. So Maurizio and Fabian wrote a very convenient formula for the expectation value of the initial charges in the Niel state here. And what we found is that actually you can reproduce all these expectation values here by just adjusting the distribution of holes of magnons. Okay, so all the local charges fix the distribution of holes of magnons. But that leaves a lot of flexibility to the other distributions that you have in there. Okay? So you just get this, this distribution of holes, which is exactly fixed. But then the quench action non-trivially reproduces this. So this is the interesting statement here. If you fit the initial values of all the charges, you only fix part of the configuration of the steady state, if you want. Okay? The quench action reproduces all these expectation values here with a more constrained form for these distributions. So we get different distributions, but the eigenvalues of the charges are all the same. Okay? So if you want, there's still too much remnant entropy in the GGE with these charges. Okay, so here are some plots. So these are then the steady state distributions, at least for the single magnons and the two strings here, for different values of the final anisotropy. All the plots that you have here are for quenching to the gapped antiferromagnetic phase. In the next slide, I'll give you distributions for the quench to the XXX point. Okay, so some characteristics. You can barely see the differences, for example, here between the full line and the dashed line. Dashed line is GGE, and full line is quench action, so the exact result. So the differences between the two are stupidly small as far as the single magnons are concerned. If you go to the string states, however, the distribution differences become quite significant. Okay? Now, so that's the statement. Quench action and GGE based on the local charges, they predict different saddle point densities, or different saddle points. So if you look at these differences here, plotted here, as a function of delta, of course, they vanish as you take delta to infinity. The differences are of order 1 over delta squared here. Okay, so since the distributions are different, you expect that the predictions for steady state expectation values, correlations, etc., are also going to be different. That's the statement here. The GGE, based on local charges, does not converge fully to the right answer. Okay, we'll get back to this. Same kinds of plots now for the quench to the isotropic point. The statement is that the more gapless you become, the larger the differences in the distributions. Okay, so you would see more of these effects if you were to quench to delta is 1 than to delta is 2. Okay, so these are just plots. Now the question is, how do these differences of distributions translate into differences in correlation functions? So these are simple nearest neighbor correlators plotted again as a function of delta. And once again, the full line is the quench action result and the dashed line is the GGE result. And here you have a plot of the difference. So in the case of the nearest neighbor correlators here, the sigma z, there's a maximal difference here at some delta, call it 1.3 or something like that. Okay? But then by just symmetry properties at delta is 1, they have to be the same. This is not going to be true for more complicated correlators. Okay, so again, in a large delta expansion here, the 1 over delta squared difference in the distributions has translated into a 1 over delta to the 6th difference in the correlations. So you have to be careful how you translate differences in distributions into differences in correlators. So the numbers that we have here are consistent with the numbers that, for example, Fabian and Maurizio published in their paper, the kind of resolution, the little delta deviation here, is very difficult to distinguish. So that's the problem The difficulty with this quench is that the predictions on the physical observables are almost indistinguishable. So if you come with an alternate numerical method to compute these differences, it has to be extremely accurate to see it. Nonetheless, so the analytical prediction is out. That's the way it is. Calculation stands. And then we'll see how it goes.
So, but JS, this seems to contradict the statement that the correlations are a smooth function of those local charges. Because if the correlations would be a smooth functions, right, they should give you, the two of them should give you the same result. Because it's like, you know, in this constrained space, you have a generalized eigenstate thermalization, and then it doesn't matter which state you pick. GGE is going to take one state, and I don't know, your quench action is going to take another one, but they both have the same distribution of local charges.
But this is not sufficiently constrained. If you want, the GGE still has too much entropy.
But that's
the simple answer is you don't know, and it's probably not true, that these ultra-local conserved charges are a complete set of...
No, that's exactly what I'm saying. Yeah. So what I'm saying, in these charges, they are not smooth functions. So there are...
They would be smooth functions. Smoothness is not a problem. Smoothness is not a problem.
So the most likely resolution is that there is a
Let me just do one and a half more slides, and then we get back to this because that's where I want to end up. Okay, so if you're not convinced, then or you think we're hallucinating, ask the guys from Budapest. Okay, so either Amsterdam and Budapest are simultaneously hallucinating. You might be excused for thinking that Amsterdam is hallucinating, but Budapest, then you can trust. These guys were simultaneously looking at all these things, and they've just put a paper out on the archive, just this one here, where they reobtain our nail results. Interestingly, they also consider different initial states. They have a different initial state where they have a kind of dimer configuration instead of nail. And interestingly, this dimer state here shows more drastic differences between the correlations as predicted from GGE and from quench action. Okay, they moreover offer some numerical evidence using ITEBD that shows that these differences are really there in the dimer case. Okay, they're clear to see in one of their figures. Now, when we saw this, I mean, of course, so we were showing our results on these things, and then everybody was saying, well, you know, you guys have made a mistake. You guys just smoke too much, even if you don't smoke. So we don't believe you, you know, just show us something. So I think since these results came out, you know, finally people believe us, and now there's now little reason to doubt the correctness of the quench action results, okay? Now the question has shifted to what is going on, really. So what's going on? Well, the current situation can be summarized as follows. So nail to XXZ, quench action solution gives you the correct solution. So all the expectation values, the local charges are reproduced. The correlations that you would obtain from that are also believable. The quench action and the GGE based on local charges definitely give different predictions. Okay? And these different distributions, so this prediction for the steady state, definitely leads to different observable expectation values. So simple correlators will be different. Possible explanations of this mismatch, okay? So we went through a number of things. So you can say that maybe you did a mistake in the quench action calculation. There were some non-trivial states. So those of you, I mean, if you want, we can talk to you about that in private. There are some maybe accumulations of rapidities at zero, some details like that. But we have ruled out this this possibility here. We're very confident that this is not the case. And therefore, really what's left is that the GGE with the local charges is just not quite refined enough. But how do you repair it? Well, it's completely trivial to repair it, provided you give us some more charges. There will be exactly like Fabian has been talking about and wrote in his recent paper, there would be some semi-local charges that you would add to this that would probably take you there. Okay, so now essentially the challenge is out. How do you repair the GGE for this? So once again, there's no kind of criticism of the logic of GGE. The criticism is based on the set of charges. Okay? So the set of charges is not sufficient to pin all the steady state values, despite the fact that it almost exactly converges. Okay, so presumably some very small additions to this would completely repair this.
But this is equivalent to saying that the observable is not smooth in those local channels, because that's exactly what you're going to do.
But we use smooth in a different language here. I think we have a different definition of smooth. So for me, smooth is really that I take rho to rho plus delta rho, and everything changes smoothly in the sense that everything becomes a functional integral with this delta rho, and if you want, the functional differential is well defined. I guess what you see, so I prefer to view it as, if you want, incompleteness of the set of charges as far as these observables are concerned, right? So. But I think you see, so that's the prediction, right? So somebody at some point will just come up with another couple of charges showing that the GGE works. Like in the Leib-Linegar-Bose gas, I've just told you about this log charge. You just allow me to put this log charge here, and then I've got a beautifully convergent GGE. It's just that you might not be happy with me writing the charge, this log charge, because when you ask me how do I write it in terms of second quantized operators, well, it is, you know, you can't write it in an intelligent, manageable fashion. It's just it's not local. But still, it's a charge. It mathematically exists, and it makes the GGE work. The same thing is going to happen here. Okay, so in a sense, the statement here would be that maybe a little bit of non-locality goes a long way. Right? It's an interesting statement. It's kind of a situation in which probably non-locality here is going to have to show its face in order to pin down the correct answer. Okay? But by the way, we already have the correct answer from the quench action, right? So if you're interested in the physics and things, you can just find it there. Okay? So I will leave you with these conclusions and perspectives, and apologize for running over a little bit. Thank you very much.